The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site, news.sciencemag.org. So Dave, first, we have a story on why anesthesia can be so disorienting.
Right, Carrie, for any of us, like myself, who have undergone general anesthesia, you know that when you wake up, you're kind of disoriented, especially if you've been out for a long time. It doesn't actually really seem like very much time has passed, unlike when you have a good night's sleep. You realize that you've been out for a while. And this new study is all about trying to figure out why that is, why anesthesia sort of mucks with our internal clock. And they didn't test this on people. They actually tested this on honeybees.
Why honeybees?
It's a good question. It turns out that actually humans aren't the only organisms on Earth that respond to anesthesia. In fact, a variety of insects and other animals respond to anesthesia very much like we do. The same concentrations seem to elicit the same effects. And the added advantage of bees is they have very strict daily cycles. If you can think about bees sort of going from flowers to hives and things like that, there are certain times of the day that they do certain things. So it's easy for researchers to figure out if their sort of whole sense of time gets screwed up.
So how did they actually study the effects of anesthesia in these bees?
Well, they looked at a common anesthesia used in humans called isoflurane. And what they did was they basically gave this to the honeybees and they tried to see whether the honeybees would have any sort of disorientation. Now, honeybees use the sun's position in addition to their internal clock. This is something called the circadian clock. We have it too. It regulates our 24-hour cycles. It's the thing that sort of makes us hungry when we wake up in the morning and makes us want to sleep when it gets dark outside. Well, honeybees have the same thing. Honeybees use that clock and they sort of coordinate it with the position of the sun to navigate to and from their hives. And what the researchers found is when they dosed the honeybees with this isoflurane, they were somewhere between 62 and 90 degrees off in trying to find their hives. And not only that, the bees that were trained to visit a feeder between 9 and 10 a.m. every day were off by about 3 hours after they had been given anesthesia. And finally, researchers actually also looked at the genetics of these bees, and they found that the mRNA that plays a role in the circadian clock was actually disrupted, and the cycles that the mRNA undergoes in the cells were off by about 4 to 5 hours after anesthesia.
So there were actually behavioral effects that they were misreading the sun because they thought it was earlier or later in the day.
Exactly.
But there were also genetic effects on top of that.
Exactly. These bees were really affected on all levels by this anesthesia.
So will this be tested in humans anytime soon?
Well, the idea is that it seems that anesthesia really sort of mucks with our internal clock. And one of the things that sets our internal clock is light. And so the researchers say, well, you know, maybe if somebody's under anesthesia, you could sort of shine a bright light on them that would sort of maybe stabilize their circadian rhythms and make them less disoriented after they wake up from surgery, but still to be tested.
Sounds pretty cool. And next up, a potential tool for people suffering from paralysis?
Right. This is another medical type story. It's about people that have paralysis, obviously have trouble or are not able at all to move their limbs. And over the past few years, scientists have developed ways to help people that have especially very severe paralysis to allow them to interact with the outside world. One technique that's been tried is to actually implant electrodes in these people's brains that help them sort of mentally control a cursor on a computer screen or even manipulate a robotic arm. There's other types of prosthetics that sort of use some residual movement. So say you still have maybe a little bit of movement in your shoulder, to use that movement to operate something like a robotic arm or other prosthesis. What this new study is doing is basically trying to combine those two things. It's trying to see, you know, can researchers take the electrical impulses that are happening in the brain and actually use those impulses on the muscles themselves to actually allow somebody who's paralyzed to manipulate an object.
So what sort of technique would be able to do that?
Well, what the researchers did was actually didn't do this on humans. They used a pair of monkeys and they implanted these electrode grids in the primary motor cortex of the monkey's brains. And this is a region that controls a lot of our body's movement. And the region they focused in on was a region that actually controls the hand. And they had these grids basically listen in on the activity of about 100 neurons in this region. And then the researchers tried to figure out, you know, when the monkeys use their hand, what pattern are these neurons firing in? And they basically decoded the information that these neurons send to the muscles in the monkey's arms. They had also implanted an electrode grid within the muscles of these monkeys' arms. And what they wanted to see is, can we take the information that's coming from the brain, give that information to the grid in the muscles, and cause the muscles to move the way the brain wants them to, even if the monkey's arm is paralyzed. And the way they paralyzed the arms of these animals was they basically just gave them a nerve-blocking drug that prohibited the monkeys from being able to do a specific task. And the task in this case was picking up a rubber ball and dropping it into a tube to earn a reward of juice.
So the first part, when they implanted these electrodes in the brain and the arm, these were in totally functional monkeys before they were paralyzed.
Right.
And they sort of sussed out the electrical signals being sent back and forth.
Right.
But then once they were paralyzed is when they tried to do this task.
Exactly. So when they were paralyzed, at first the monkeys couldn't obviously pick up the ball and drop it into the tube. But when the researchers recreated the signal that the brain would have been sending to the arm, then all of a sudden the monkeys were able to pick up the ball and drop it in the tube as if their arm was functional again, even though it was technically paralyzed.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. So has this been tested in humans?
This hasn't been tested in humans yet, although the researchers say, you know, the same fundamental principle should work just fine in humans. They're thinking about a clinical trial now. These things take a few years, but they really do think that this could offer hope to people that have pretty severe paralysis. Mm-hmm.
And in our third story, we have a totally bizarre methodology for studying migratory birds.
Right. This story, well, let me just cut to the chase. This story has to do with a 2-meter-high pile of bird poop. And this was found by a research technician at a university in Canada. And he wasn't really looking for bird poop. What he was looking for was he was looking for some habitats on his university's campus that may have been used by a bird known as the chimney swift. And the chimney swift is this migratory bird. It flies pretty long distances. But the birds have been really dying out over the past few decades. In fact, about 95% of the population has disappeared between 1968 and 2005. So he was wondering, you know, maybe it has something to do, you know, these guys like to hang out in chimneys. Maybe we've been doing something with our chimneys that have caused the birds to die out. But he wasn't sure. And he started looking through some chimneys on campus. And that's where he came across this huge pile of bird excrement at the bottom of a 5-story high chimney.
So when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. And so he said, well, life gives me 2 meters of bird poop, so I...
Right. I don't know if there's a... He didn't make a lemonade with it. But what he did do is he said, you know, I work in this lab that studies sediments in lakes. And what we do in our lab is we can sift through these sediments, and the lower down you go in the sediment, the further back in time that you go. And he said, you know, could we do the same thing with this bird poop? He knew that the bird poop had come from chimney swifts, and it seemed to have been deposited there over decades. So the question was, could we learn something about why these birds started to disappear by sort of digging through the layers of this bird poop?
So I'm curious for how he age-dated this bird poop, because it was not deposited out in sort of the elements the way that normal, you know, lake sediments are.
Sure, right. It was a great question. And it turns out they use something called radioisotope dating. And this is a complicated story, but basically ever since nations started detonating nuclear bombs around the World War II era, radioisotopes from these nuclear bombs have been deposited in all of our bodies, even up until now. So all of us still have signatures of nuclear bomb testing in our bodies. These signatures have decreased over the decades, and by looking at anything, whether it's a human being or bird poop, you can actually figure out, based on the level of radioisotopes, when somebody was born, and in this case, when this bird poop was deposited. And the researchers figured out that the deposited sort of stretched from about 1944 to 1992. And 1992 is actually when the chimney was capped, which makes sense because the birds couldn't get in there anymore and they weren't able to deposit their excrement.
Okay, so now they know the time span of when this was all laid down. So what else were they able to find?
So what they did was they actually got in the chimney and they started digging through the bird poop to get, you know, samples from various layers. And what they found is the samples at the very bottom, you know, these were the ones that would be the farthest back in time, had a very high concentration of beetles. And that meant the birds were probably eating a lot of beetles during this time. But as they got higher up in the layer, sort of more recent history, there were fewer and fewer beetles and more other types of bugs known as true bugs, which include species like stink bugs and cicadas. And the interesting thing about that is that beetles are actually a lot more nutritious. And these birds, as I said at the beginning, you know, these are long migrating birds. They spend a lot of time in the sky. They need a lot of energy. So the beetles are great food for them. But when they stopped eating beetles and started eating these other bugs were less nutritious and probably contributed to the bird's decline. And the reason beetles started disappearing, the researchers also found different concentrations of pesticides like DDT. There were more concentrations of these pesticides when the beetles started to disappear. And the idea is that pesticides in the environment may have contributed to the decline of beetles, which in turn contributed to the decline of the chimney swift.
Wow. So what else have we had on the news site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about balancing on tightropes and how mathematicians have found the best way to do it. And also a story about the first gas giants. These are planets like Jupiter that formed in the Milky Way. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a rash of new spending bills that are sort of making their way through the U.S. Congress and what impact they could have on agencies from NOAA to the National Science Foundation to NASA. And we've also got a story about a new uproar about tobacco research in China. Mm-hmm. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about human-triggered earthquakes, what impact we're having on the shaking of Mother Nature. And next week's Science Live is about the controversial flu studies that have been in the news for the past few weeks. What is the latest that's going on with them, and how will it impact the publication of controversial scientific research in the future? So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Great. I will. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.